To Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yana. We were discussing a news item, the gruesome not only beating of four university students in Nigeria, but the fact that the crowd burned them alive. And they burned them alive not because they were caught stealing a laptop or a cell phone or whatever it was that they were originally alleged to be stealing. They were burned alive for being part of a cult. The chat rooms in Nigeria were filled with the following kind of comments. I'm just going to share one with you because it reflects that of so many. It reads, "Fools, why were these boys cultists or not? That is the only question that should be answered. If the question is no, then this was a tragedy. However, if the answer is yes, if they were cultists, then to hell with any numbskull that sees the jungle justice meted out to them as a big deal." In other words, anyone who thinks that people ought not be beat over the heads with sticks, drugged through the streets naked, and then set on fire so they could be burned alive, that those people are numbskulls. You are a numbskull if you watch that video and think what happened to those boys was wrong, according to this individual and many more like them. The whole us versus them nonsense that so-called Uniport students were orchestrating really begs the question. If there is a fellow, if it's sure that these fellow students were cultists, then they are the ones who are spoiling for war. Nigeria has bigger problems, this individual wrote, to worry about than a few violent animals that were lynched on the account of their crimes. They weren't lynched. Lynched is hanging. They were burned alive. Some of us are not carried away by the social media hype that is going on here. And then he says, who massacred 40 students in Mumbai? Who are the bastards that have been bombing our churches and killing hundreds of innocent worshippers? Who are the kidnappers giving us sleepless nights? How do we eliminate the countless armed robbers threatening millions of our families across the country? These are the real problems that require our attention, not cooking up a useless storm over cultists that met a deserved Waterloo. Now, the reality here is what this person is saying is we ought to be calling the Muslims bad for doing things like this and not being at all focused on the Christian behavior. No, let's not look at the Christian behavior. Let's only look at how bad the Muslim behavior is. That's what they're saying. Another person wrote, once we were shouting, Boko Haram, Boko Haram. That's the name of the fundamentalist Islamic group that is terrorizing Nigeria. Says, after watching the video, this person says, I wept. What those villagers did to those boys was worse than anything that Boko Haram has ever done. You won't find a Muslim killing another Muslim in such a gruesome manner. And to imagine that fellow Christian can do that to ourselves is so shameful. I'll bet you Boko Haram Muslims must have had a good laugh watching the video. And indeed, you see, the primary response that Islamic terrorists have to the fact that Islam, fundamentalist Muslims in particular, perpetrate 99.9% of the terrorist acts today, is to say, you know, we're not alone. There's terrorists that are not Muslims. They'll mention the non-existent IRA, which, by the way, wasn't a terrorist organization. They were a guerrilla organization. They went after police and military. And they killed scores of people, not millions of people. But they'll mention that. They'll say, well, this was a terrorist act. And they'll say, see, these were Christians doing it, so you can't just blame Islam. And that is what this has caused. Now, I wanted to find out what the cult was, because it is, as we move towards the tribulation, you're going to find more and more of this. Anyone Conditions are going to get so miserable that people are going to be looking for scapegoats, for someone to blame. And anyone who doesn't toe the popular line in whatever community it is, that doesn't go to church or go to the mosque or go and support political correctness, that anyone who is outside the circle of what is acceptable is going to be ruthlessly killed in this way. And you're going to see a great expansion of gang-related activity, of what people will do in a gang that they would not do individually, prompted by culture. And so I did some research to find out what these cults were all about. And come to find out, they are university fraternities, is what these cults are about. Their beliefs were all created in the late 1970s, early 1980s. This particular one that these four cultists belonged to was called the Mafia Khan Fraternity. Their belief systems include: it is better for a bastard to provoke a member than for a numbered bastard. That means a member of another cult group. Retaliation is always the response. Secrecy is where our power lies. And we believe in gambling, in partying, and having fun with girls. That's their basis of this cult. Another one is the Black Axe Khan Fraternity. It was formed to oppose the influence of any Caucasian in their country and in the world. Now, mind you that Nigeria doesn't have Caucasian influences. But nonetheless, it says this, their belief system: the black man will be freed with the axe. Forgiveness is a sin. Don't betray your brother in the hood. Obey. Don't complain. The Buccaneer Association of Nigeria, another one of these Khan fraternities, they're called the Pirates. Their mantra is blood for blood. Let the devil that led you guide you. That is the cult that these boys had joined. Does it justify killing them in this way? No. Because in America and in Western Europe, when you speak on behalf of Yahweh, when you tell people that your religion is false if you're a Christian, that it's unreliable, that it's counterproductive, that it angers God, that when you say those things, or if you say that Islam is satanic in an Islamic country, you'll be labeled a cultist, and they will go after you the same way. And we're going to see more and more of this. It is the easy response. You see, most people who are religious are incapable of evidence and reason. They are incapable of defending their belief. And so what they do is they slander the messenger, and they say demeaning things of the messenger. They try to put the messenger in a little box so they can stuff them away off to the side. And it doesn't matter, even if the messenger speaks on behalf of God, even if their evidence and reason are irrefutable. You simply ignore what they said. You put a little label around them. You spew some religious slogans at them. Accuse them of being part of a cult. And there you have it. And that is what we are going to witness over these next decade to two decades throughout America, throughout the world. And it brings us back to a letter that was written by an advocate of Christianity that attempted to do the same thing. I simply told this individual when they wrote me praising how effective Prophet of Doom was and exposing and condemning Islam based upon its own scriptures, and they told me about how wonderful the Christian God was, particularly their Jesus Christ. And I told them there was no Jesus Christ. Bogus title, bogus name, and that God's not a Christian. And they had a conniption fit over that. And all the points that I made in the first letter, none of them did this individual address. They were incapable of doing it. You know, they filled with errors, pointed out their errors, were unable to deal with any of them. Just move on to a new taunt. This is the latest as we were reviewing this person's letter. It says, "While I sympathize with a zealous defense for what you believe to be the truth." Now, you see, a religious person believes in a zealous defense of their faith. So they can sympathize with that. Now, was I defending a faith? No. So, I'm not defending the belief system. Simply presenting what God says as truth. Has nothing to do with what I believe. But you see, for the person who is religious, when they're confronted with evidence from God, they're incapable of processing that as God's testimony. What they instead have to do is ascribe that message to the individual who is bringing the message and to disassociate that message with God. You should be careful not to impose legislative requirements on mere pronouncements, they wrote. You should be careful not to impose legislative requirements on mere pronouncements. I sincerely wish you all the best in your bold proclamation of the truth about Islam. In other words, you can speak boldly about Islam all you want, but don't be criticizing my religion. Even if the means that you're going to criticize my religion is the exact same means, comparing their scriptures, that you used against Islam, I don't like it here. I like it there. I don't like it here. Well, Stephen's line saying that I ought not impose legislative requirements from mere pronouncements is code. It's code for the Christian aversion to both pronouncing Yahweh's name and to his Torah, which they consider law, and therefore legislative is the antithesis of grace. And so the Torah is the antithesis of grace, and a mere pronouncement ought not be considered. But more on that in a moment. There are 7,000 times in the Torah, Prophets and Psalms, that Yahweh pronounces his one and only name. And he tells us to listen to what he had to say, to observe what he had written. Now, it's a name that Yahweh, who just happens to be God, just happens to be the creator of the universe, just happens to be the author of life, just happens to be the witness who provided the Torah. There are 7,000 times that this very same God managed to spell his name correctly. Imagine that. 7,000 times he managed to spell his name correctly, and yet what this Christian apologist will say is we should ignore all of that, we should discount all of that, and we should feel free, empowered, and justified in changing God's name. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
Jim Newcomer.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You can join this discussion by calling 877-300-7645. You know, if God's name, which he wrote, spelled correctly, mind you, 7,000 times, I assume he spelled it correctly. After all, he etched it in stone, and he spelled it exactly the same way all 7,000 times that appears in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. I know I'm being a bit presumptive here, but I figure that if you could conceive the DNA double helix, if you could conceive that code as a written language, which is because it's a multidimensional language as opposed to just static letters on a page, if you could conceive the code, the alphabet that is necessary for life, and you could conceive the formula that was required to determine how much energy had to be imparted to the system to create the universe as we know it, I presume that you know how to spell your own name. I know it's presumptuous of me, but I presume that you probably know how to spell your own name. And so if you think that he doesn't, you think that you are free to disregard God's preference for what we call him, then, you know, I've got some suggestions, and they're equally as valid as the Christian Jesus. I mean, why not Allah? Why not call him Sheba? Why not Adolf? It's got a nice ring to it, doesn't it? How about Caesar? How about Barack Obama? It's got a multicultural flair to it. I think, you know, a great name for God would be Scott. How about that?
I'm going to veto.
Or if
that
you prefer, you don't want to poke a finger in his eye, huh? Let's see. Or you don't want the job. I don't want the job either.
We'll go both.
How about both? Let's call the father of Jeebus. How about Jerkoff? It's as close to Yahusha as Jesus is. Why not call him Jackass? I mean, after all, the only use of Jesus in a religious context prior to it being deployed in the third edition of the King Iams Bible in the mid-17th century was that Jesus was the savior of the Druid religion where the Horned One was God. Well, you don't like that? How about Jockitch? Jambalaya. That's got a nice ring to it. Or why not just Jumbled Liar? It doesn't matter. It shouldn't be imposed a religious view on this. We shouldn't legislate the pronouncement. Why don't we just choose Jumbled Liar? Yes, Scott?
It's weird that they would change it because it's such a... It's actually such an easy thing to say. Yeah.
But see, for the Christian religion to be effective, Yahweh has to cease being God. He has to be, his Old Testament has to be the will and testimony of a now deceased deity. There needs to be a new religion, a new testament, and a new God, a new and improved God who comes in the form of a man. Ah, Jesus. But if we call him by his real name, if we call him Yahusha, then we can't get away from Yahweh, the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, because Yahusha means Yahweh saves. Well, that's a problem, because that identifies who he is and what God is doing here in our midst. So they needed to create an entirely different name for their new and improved and different God, because they didn't much like the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, because there's no way to make any money off him. There's no way to create a religion. There's no way to create a political mandate. You can't make a buck on the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. You can't oppress people. He's opposed to oppression. He's opposed to religion. So they needed to create a new and different God for their religion. And so they made up a name. Literally made it up. Has no basis whatsoever. You would not be any closer to the truth with Jumbled Liar than with Jesus. It has no basis. It's wrong. It's completely made up. It isn't a transliteration replicating the sound, nor a translation of anything found in Scripture. And yet this moron, this idiot, this nincompoop, who wrote not one letter but four or five, continues to advance it. Now, I'm here to tell you, if you're praying to Jesus and you've not been told that that name was invented in the 17th century, if you've not been told that, if you've not been told there was no J until the middle of the 17th century, if you haven't been told that there is no Iusu, Iusus, Iusun written in any of the first 70 extant manuscripts of the so-called Christian New Testament, all of those that predate Constantine, and that divine placeholders were used instead, and that there's a history of the use of those placeholders in the Septuagint, you've not been told any of those things, then you have an excuse. But the moment you are exposed to the truth, you are without excuse. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You're encouraged to call to discuss these topics at 877-300-7645. I must ask, because this individual accused me of being arrogant. He accused me of being arrogant because I called Paul a false prophet. I don't know why that's arrogant, but what I think is arrogant is thinking that we have the authority to change God's name, that we are justified in creating a name for God that's of our own choosing. That is to say that we are right and that God's name is Jesus and that God is wrong when he says his name is Yahweh. I mean, think of the arrogance of that. And then, once you know the truth, to continue to advocate the lie. That you think you're following God, you present yourself as being someone who is inspired by God, and you negate and disregard what he said. But the stupidity of that baffles me. This is what Yahweh said. Let's just turn to his testimony. It's the only one that counts. He wrote in Yeshayah 42:8. Now, if you can't find Yeshayah, which means salvation is from Yah, then you may want to look up Isaiah. Yeshayah 42:8. I am Yahweh. He didn't say, I am Jesus. He didn't say, I am Christ. He didn't say, I am Jehovah. He didn't say, I am the Lord. He said, speaking in first person, I am Yahweh. This is my name. And my significance and my merit, I will not give to another. Nor will I offer my renown and reputation to religious imagery. Jesus Christ is a religious image. He bears nothing in common with Yahusha. Stephen, of course, was a fan when he noted that I boldly presented the truth about Islam using the Islamic scriptures to expose and condemn the religion. But boldly presenting the truth about his religion and using Yah's scriptural testimony isn't appreciated. Four entire volumes of my most recent book, which is a volume of books, called The Introduction to God. You can find it at introtogod.org. Are devoted expressly to what Yahweh has to say about his Torah teaching. And some 700 pages of an introduction to God are exclusively devoted to presenting what Yahweh had to say about his own Torah. But put that in perspective, that's longer than the entire so-called Christian New Testament. And yet, I only cover about a quarter of Yahweh's guidance regarding his teaching. And yet, disregarding all of this, discounting it completely, even arguing against it, Christian apologists exclusively cite Paul's animosity toward the Torah as justification for ignoring it, and for ignoring the God who authored it. So the question is, why would anyone in their right mind believe a man who claimed to speak for the very God he contradicted? The very man who says that God's testimony in his Torah is to be disregarded, that it cannot save, that it's of the flesh, that it's a cruel taskmaster. Why would anyone believe that he actually spoke for the God who authored that guidance? Who said just the opposite? That's why there are no rational and informed Christians. Let's consider two of the thousands of references that Yahweh has to his Torah. This, too, is from Yeshayah. It's from Yeshayah 42:21. Yahweh was willing, even desirous, for the sake of his sense of honesty and fairness and his commitment to doing what is right, to reveal his nurturing and enriching Torah, his teaching and instruction, his guidance and direction, and then to prove its worth. How did Yahweh prove the worth of his Torah guidance? He did it really in two ways. He told us in his Torah guidance, in his Torah instructions, that if we embrace what he has to say, we will become immortal, that we will become perfect, that we will become his children, adopted into his family, that we will be enriched and empowered by him. And that he said that those who embrace this teaching will benefit from it in so many ways. And he then demonstrated it tangibly in human history, leading his children away from the religious and political, military and economic crucible that enslaved them and impressed them in Egypt. He then demonstrated it in the life of Dodd, in the creation of Yisrael as a nation. But the same God said, you also need to know, for me to prove the value of what I'm sharing with you, that if you choose to ignore it, to disregard it, as Christians do, here's the consequence. I want you to witness in this control group, we're going to call them the Nation of Yisrael. In this control group, I want you to witness the consequence of opposing my guidance. This is what's going to happen to my people as a result of this. And they did. They opposed it. Look what happened to them. God proved its merit. When God was proving the validity of his promises, the most important 4 days in human history occurred. And yet, there isn't a Christian that knows these 4 days. Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuot in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, when Yahweh set part of himself apart, diminished an aspect of his nature, transforming an aspect of his spiritual energy into a corporeal, material manifestation. And he himself fulfilled, honored his promises, enabling them on our behalf on those days. Here's a second reference to the Torah. Yahweh's Torah, his written instruction and teaching, his source of direction and guidance, is complete and entirely perfect, without defect, lacking nothing, genuine, right, helpful, healing, beneficial and true, returning, restoring, and transforming the soul. Yahweh's testimony, his enduring witness, is trustworthy and reliable, verifiable, confirming, supportive, making understanding and obtaining wisdom simple for the open-minded. Think of that. This testimony from Yahweh, who just happens to be God, completely destroys the basis of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I say Judaism because the whole purpose of the Talmud is that religious Jews, rabbis, said that, Torah that God authored, way too complicated for you to understand. The only way that you can appreciate any of it is to listen to our arguments on it. The Talmud. God saying, no. My testimony, my enduring witness, is not only trustworthy and reliable, it's not only confirming, it's easy to understand if you're open-minded. What is the excuse for Christianity? Oh, the excuse for Christianity is that the Torah was not complete, that the Torah was imperfect, that the Torah was not healing and beneficial, but exactly the opposite of those things, that the Torah could not restore our souls. But God said just the opposite. The very basis of Pauline doctrine was destroyed by this statement, a statement made by God 1,500 years before the slime known as Paul poisoned humanity through his letters, saying exactly the opposite. Oh, Islam says that Torah was incomplete, and the last prophet had to reveal a Quran that says that what God told you wasn't really trustworthy back then, and that it wasn't complete. I've got to add all of this new stuff to it. Three religions, destroyed on a single statement. And why are the religions destroyed on this single statement? Because all three of these religions claim that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms were inspired by God. And yet the very God of those Torah, prophets, and Psalms just undermined the entire basis of their religion. So if that God isn't trustworthy, their religions aren't trustworthy because they say they're based on that God and his testimony. And if that God's testimony is credible, if he really is God, as they claim him to be, then their religions aren't credible because their religions are destroyed by this statement and so many others like it. It is why, my friends, it is impossible to be an informed and rational participant in the Jewish religion, Islamic religion, or Christian religion. Your religion is destroyed. It's absolutely rendered moot, counterproductive, dishonest by the very God that you claim was its inspiration. That's not possible. When the same strategy was applied to Christianity, as was applied to Islam and Prophet of Doom, exposing and condemning the religion based upon its scriptures, Stephen cried foul. Even when he was shown to be wrong, he was not deterred. You know, he said that Yahweh was based upon Jehovah and Adonai. It's not. Told him where to look. Was he able to tie Shalom and Eloah and Torah and Goyim and Haya to the pronunciation of Yah's name? Was he ever able to say, you know, I was wrong about that. I was wrong that God has but one name and that he told us how to pronounce it. And I was wrong about Jesus, Iusus, the placeholders, and Paul's corruptions. No. Simply went to another excuse. I am Yada. This is Shattering the... Shattering Myths. We're continuing with a letter from a Christian apologist, and we're going to use it for a number of shows because it just provides an ideal platform to shatter the myth of this religion and how it is defended. So this individual's name is Stephen. Prior to writing Cheer Stephen, he says, one last thought. Every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So that's his quote. It puts in quote, every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And then he writes, i.e., in other words, and he puts this in quote, that Yeshua, Y-E-S-H-A-S-H-U-A, it means whoever Yeh is, and I have no idea who Yeh is, but that Yeh cries out. Shua in Hebrew isn't from the same root as Yasha, and it doesn't mean that Yahweh saves and Yah's name has been obliterated from this. Then he has HaMashiach and as a title. Do you know that HaMashiach, the title that is translated Messiah in English, is never used as a title? Nope. In fact, in the famous passage where it is the only place where it actually is presented as if it were a title, in Daniel, which speaks of the arrival of Yah's messenger, and it is written as Mashiach. Guess what? There's no ha. The ha is the Hebrew word for the. There is no the. In fact, it's used as an adjective on both occasions in Daniel. And so it is modifying a noun. In the case of the most profound of these, speaking of his arrival, where it says that he shall be cut off but not for himself, the noun that Mashiach is modifying is messenger. So there is no title. HaMashiach. Thought you'd find that interesting. Anyway, he says Yeshua, which is a rabbinic corruption of his name. It's based on an acronym, is he whose name shall be blotted out. HaMashiach, showing something as a title that is not written as a title. Who Ha Edom. He's got here who as if who was a H-U, was the verb in the sentence. If it's going to be the verb is, then it needs to be the Hebrew verb haya, which is the very basis of Yahweh's name. So in his first letter, he says, I know that, you know, that the verb is, to be, is the basis of his name, and yet he doesn't include it here and uses instead a truncated version of the pronoun, the masculine pronoun. Who is H-U-W would be the masculine pronoun, he in Hebrew, and that's what he has as the verb. But he wants to impress us that, wow, he can translate what he translated out of Greek into Hebrew and got every part of it wrong, including the ha edon at the end of it, because God never uses the term the Lord in reference to himself. So, what I wrote is that's wrong too, and in many ways. First, it is from Philippians, which is in Scripture, since Paul was a false prophet. And for absolute proof of that, I encouraged Stephen, and I encourage you, if you aren't yet convinced that Paul was a false prophet, to read questioningpaul.com, the 700-page analysis of Paul's first letter, that written to the Galatians and the Galatians, to pronounce their name more accurately, and it provides irrefutable proof, overwhelming proof, undeniable proof, that Paul lied, that he was a false prophet. The name is wrong, as are both titles. Further, as with all of Paul's quotations, it is an errant and truncated paraphrase of a passage from Yah's word, this time from Yashayah, which was removed from its context and then manipulated to mislead. If you knew Yahweh, you would know that he does not want his covenant children bowing down to him. Those bowing before him are being judged. So here is what Paul actually wrote in Philippians. And then we're going to consider it from Romans, which preceded Philippians by many years. And the order of things, Paul initially wrote his letter to the Galatians, and then he had his two anti-Semitic rants to Thessalonica, and then two letters to Corinth, followed by the letter to the Romans. And unfortunately, we're out of time on today's program. We're going to pick this up, and we're going to have a good time exposing the myth that is Pauline doctrine in our program tomorrow. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
A year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact that most...